Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit is now open according to law. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning. We have four appeals to hear this morning. I know that at least in some of these appeals, several issues are raised, and with the limited time that is available to each counsel, you should feel free to get straight to the heart of your argument, the most important parts of your argument. We've read your briefs, the authority cited in your briefs, and at least portions of the record, so we're familiar with the case. You don't need to give us background information when you begin. You can assume that we're familiar with the issues, and anything you're not able to address, we will, of course, still have under submission, that so long as that issue was raised in the briefs. So we have four cases. We're going to begin this morning with Regions Bank versus Kaplan. Mr. Perkins.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Joe Perkins on behalf of Regions Bank. We have reserved 3 minutes for reply, and my argument will focus on the points in Regions' initial brief appeal of the final judgment, and we rest on the briefs in connection with the cross appeal and the consolidated sanctions appeal. Your Honors, this is a case where reversal is appropriate because in the face of a mountain of evidence, the court made four findings that did not have a bearing on the case or Regions' claims and used those findings to credit Mr. Kaplan's mere denials at trial. The first of those findings was that Mr. Kaplan did not directly contact Bridgeview Bank to induce payments of the Smith Advertising checks drawn on the Smith Advertising account at that bank. But check kiting does not require a party to call the other bank and ask the bank to cover the checks. It was uncontradicted below that Mr. Kaplan's wires on 29 out of 30 days of the kite period were necessary to enable Bridgeview to honor the checks. The second question that the court answered but had no bearing on the case was the court's crediting Mr. Kaplan's mere denials that he did not know the specific balances of the Bridgeview account at any given time. But knowledge of specific balances is unnecessary. And as the Skadif case that we cited holds, Judge Hoover discussed how constructive knowledge alone that checks are NSF upon deposit equals fraudulent presentment. Meanwhile, Regions presented overwhelming evidence that Mr. Kaplan had actual, if not constructive, knowledge that the checks he was depositing were NSF. The court ignored Mr. Kaplan's own testimony that it was his understanding that the very predicate of these bundled deals was insufficient funds in the Smith Advertising bank account. The court acknowledged but ignored the first email from Todd Smith that explained the logic of the so-called bundled deals, the February 11th email, where Mr. Smith explained that if he had the money to do these deals on his own, he would do it. The court ignored the Thursday, December 2nd, 2011 email. The email that Mr. Smith sent to Marvin Kaplan in connection with the first kite rotation, where Mr. Smith explained very expressly that on a Thursday, I will mail you the checks. You deposit the checks Friday morning. My customer's payment will not post until midnight Friday, which really means Monday. And Mr. Kaplan himself testified that he understood that posting of a check does not mean clear. You have to wait for a check to clear after it posts. The court also found in its trial findings that Mr. Kaplan understood the check collection process. He understood that Regions was providing provisional credit for these checks. He understood what float time meant for collecting checks. He understood that Regions would not know that checks were dishonored until Bridgeview Bank determined not to pay them and notified Regions of that fact. Regions presented evidence that Mr. Kaplan himself, when this kite collapsed, admitted that the purpose of using checks in these wires for checks exchanges was to leverage the check float, something that Mr. Kaplan, an admission that Mr. Kaplan himself does not deny. With the third question.
Hi, this is Robert Luck. Let me ask you a question. If for some reason, let's assume for the moment that this was a legitimate, that what Smith Advertising was doing was legitimate. In fact, that there were these contracts that were bundled or contracts that they were trying to exploit a discount for paying right away. Assume that for me. I know it wasn't, but assume that for me for a moment. And let's assume for the moment that Mr. Kaplan believed that to be the case, that there were actually discounts and that he was receiving that. Would this be a check kite if everything else was the same?
Yes, it would, and it would certainly be fraudulent concealment. And there are two cases that stand for that proposition. One is the Skidiv case, where it's the depositing of the NSF checks that results in fraud upon presentment. The other is a decision of this court in Morales, where, again, the hope that the depositing of NSF checks hoping for future funds, hoping for future deposits.
But Mr. Perkins, my hypothetical is more than just hoping. I understand the propositions that you're arguing, but assuming that this was real and that at least for 8 years while this was going on, that there had been these discounts that had been exploited for prompt payment or for immediate payment, and that discount was split, and that Mr. Kaplan had an eight-year history of benefiting from that, and assuming that that was actually true and was, in fact, happening, including with the bundles, this is more than a hope for. This is they know that they are going to cover whatever the short-term spread is in the BridgeView account, right?
That's not correct for two reasons. First, it's very important to distinguish the check collection issues with the bundle deals where Mr. Kaplan was sending wires and depositing.
I know you make that argument, but why can't the trial court in its findings credit the testimony of Mr. Kaplan that for 8 years he had this business relationship with Smith, he believed that what they were doing was legitimate, and he didn't see how, and because of that, he believed that what was going on with the bundling was also legitimate. Why can't the trial court credit that?
Because even if Mr. Kaplan believed that the Smith end of the print contract transactions was legitimate, Regions presented a mountain of evidence that Mr. Kaplan knew he was depositing NSF checks, hoping that future, again, assuming that Mr. Kaplan sincerely believed that the Smith Advertising end of the transaction was true, even the hope that future payments from the customers of Smith into the BridgeView Bank account would cover the NSF checks that Mr. Kaplan was depositing, that is fraud under the Morales case.
Yeah, but there seems to be a difference between hoping, and which I understand, meaning, you know, I think this is going to all work out, but I don't really know, versus I believe and I know based on a significant experience with this company that there is no NSF and there is no fraud and no cover because no check had been declined or sent, returned to maker or non-sufficient funds for the eight-year relationship, right?
Well, no. For the entire relationship other than the last portion of the kite period, the 30 days, Mr. Kaplan waited at minimum 15 days to deposit the principal repayment check. He usually waited 30 to 60 days. The circular rotation of checks for wires is something that was brand new, that was completely new and only started during the kite period. And the fact that there were no check collection issues during the kite period, it happened because by definition there was a check kite. And at the end it collapsed. So since even if we gave Mr. Kaplan a sincere belief of the Smith Advertising end of the transactions, which, by the way, the evidence was that Mr. Kaplan deposited loan repayment principal checks before even funding the wires in certain instances, that still doesn't change the fact that Mr. Kaplan, as he admitted, was leveraging the check float. He was putting Regions Bank at risk to invest in whatever he believed to be occurring with Smith Advertising. And that gives rise to a duty to disclose, because if Mr. Kaplan had told the bank, I'm going to deposit NSF checks in these accounts, if Mr. Kaplan had told the bank, I am doing business whereby I am by design leveraging the check flow, then Regions would have shut it down, just like it did on January 25th when Mr. Kaplan admitted it. And Judge Luck, you know, another point is the predicate for these deals was insufficient funds in the Smith Advertising account. So you had asked, well, why couldn't Mr. Kaplan believe that these checks were supported by sufficient funds because he had a history with Todd Smith and Smith Advertising? But Mr. Smith told Mr. Kaplan that when I have the money in my account to do this, I do it myself. I reach out to you when there is not enough money to do this, when I don't have the money to do this. And Mr. Kaplan admitted that fact multiple times at trial below as well.
Let me direct your attention. This is Robin Rosenbaum. Let me direct your attention for a moment to the motion to dismiss, if I could. With respect to, you know, as you may recall, there are several allegations for which the district court concluded a qualified privilege applied. But with respect specifically to the bulletin allegation and the Wells Fargo Bank and Federal Bank Association allegation, it seems to me that I'm sorry, can you hear me?
Yes, I'm sorry. This is Joe Perkins. I was disconnected from the call in the middle of arguments. My apologies, Your Honor.
That's okay. This is Robin Rosenbaum, and I have a question concerning the motion to dismiss.
Okay.
With respect to the motion to dismiss, as you may recall, Kaplan argued that the complaint alleged malice or the lack of good faith, and the district court dismissed the claims with respect to the with respect to all of the allegations concerning the bulletin allegation, the Wells Fargo and Federal Bankers Association allegation. With respect to the bulletin allegation and the Wells and Federal Bankers Association allegations, the issue there was whether the complaint alleged good faith. And my concern there is that the complaint does allege that Regions made the bulletin allegation and the Wells Fargo Bank and Federal Bankers Association allegation for an improper purpose. And so it seems to me like that would be inconsistent with alleging that it was done in good faith. So why isn't that an error?
Because the qualified privilege is not forfeited, Judge, if the communication serves a proper interest. And here, the allegations of Mr. Kaplan's own, you know, completing gave rise to that proper interest. So Regions had an interest as a bank to communicate to the FDA. Regions had a legitimate banking interest. So because that's the fact, even if hostility existed, qualified immunity would still apply.
Thank you.
Thank you. The other questions that the court below answered that had no bearing on the ultimate claims were that, first, that there were non-Kaplan funds in the Smith Advertising accounts, but this has no bearing on whether or not Mr. Kaplan was check-kiting to fund the Smith Advertising transactions. First, during every single day, the amount of funds in the Smith Advertising account from other sources was de minimis compared to Mr. Kaplan's wires. And during every single day of the kite period, with one exception, December 29, Mr. Kaplan's cover wires were necessary to enable Virgue to pay the checks. And then, so there are, of course, three bases giving rise to a duty to speak for a fraudulent concealment claim. Here, the court...
Counsel, your time has expired.
Mr. Perkins, you can continue for about a minute more since you were interrupted, but do bring it to a close here.
Thank you, Judge. To bring it to a close, one, the court never addressed whether a duty arose because of a misleading partial disclosure, a failure to disclose that he was leveraging the float, failure to disclose even constructively that the predicate of his investments was insufficient funds in the Virgue account. The court also, in question number four of the first page of the findings, the court asked, identified as a material issue on appeal, whether or not Mr. Kaplan diverted funds after the kite collapsed. Although she identified that as a material issue, although she made a finding of fact that Mr. Kaplan identified that diverted $1.4 million that from checks that were deposited into the region's account to another account, the court never tied them together, and the court ignored another $804,000 that was diverted into the Kaplan entities.
Okay. All right, Mr. Perkins, you've saved 3 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Wyrick.
Good morning, Your Honors. This is Attorney Jonathan Wyrick. May it please the court. I'm here on behalf of the appellees, cross-appellants Marvin Kaplan, R1A Palms, Triple Net Exchange, B&K Smith, and NK Investing, LLC. For the sake of clarity, I'll be referring to the various Kaplan entities by their abbreviated names as used throughout the briefing. Your Honors, I'd like to address a couple of the points that Mr. Perkins had made in his argument just now and also that keeps coming up in these briefings. And the most significant one is that the court's findings with respect to Mr. Kaplan's knowledge of what was going on were entirely consistent with his testimony and also with third-party corroborative evidence as to what was going on here. I know that the court is familiar with the background of this case, but it bears mentioning again that while all this was ongoing, there was a significant federal investigation of all of these issues. In fact, it became part of the record, both being read into the record and being entered in as an exhibit, the indictment against the Smiths as well as the statements of various confidential informants. The FBI also and Secret Service also provided substantial information about their investigation, which included the very transactions that are at issue here. All of that is found in docket number 774-11, where the relevant portions were in fact read into the record. But turning to the idea that these deals were always conditioned on there being insufficient funds in the Smith account, Mr. Kaplan never admitted that there was going to be float leveraging at that time. In fact, the very testimony that is cited to by Regions Bank does not support that he was admitting that. In fact, later on in that testimony, and I'm referring to, I believe it's 774-6, starting on page 148 and forward, Mr. Kaplan expressly testified that at no time while these transactions were going on did he think that these funds were not in the Smith account or available once he cashed the checks and deposited them. And I'd have the court recall that the testimony throughout the proceeding was that SAA would reach out to him to go in on these print deals as 50-50 investors, meaning that if Kaplan wired up $10 million, for example, the expectation was that the deals were combined for $20. Therefore, SAA would have to have at least $10 million already in its account to act on the deals. If Kaplan was getting called the night before by Smith asking for more funds, which is what was occurring, the expectation was certainly that SAA already had the money to pony up its end of the deal the next day, and that's well before new client payments were coming in.
Doesn't Mr. Perkins point to the email that was sent by one of the SAA principals that was eventually forwarded or shared with Mr. Kaplan that stated that they didn't have the funds in order to do this and they needed the funds, and yet checks were sent by FedEx or overnighted or even flown on a private jet down to Mr. Kaplan in advance of wiring that money. So wasn't there the knowledge that there was insufficient funds before the wires were sent, yet checks were in hand?
No, Your Honor, and I think the district court correctly found that in this particular instance, there's a difference and a distinction between saying I have a negative account balance or I have zero funds in my account to do this deal, or I just need the additional money because of my other expenses and other overages. The bottom line here is that Mr. Kaplan would not have had any way of knowing what was going on in the Smith operating account. And in fact, the testimony and evidence that was received was consistent with the fact that the Smiths had a number of other deals going on with a number of other investors. In fact, you know, returning back to docket 774-11, the FBI and Secret Service detailed a number of multi-million dollar transactions that were ongoing at the same time that Mr. Kaplan's transactions were ongoing.
Well, just because the FAA and their principals were fraudsters doesn't mean that this wasn't a fraud. But isn't your best argument that there are two ways to read it, that email, one being that there was insufficient funds, the other being that that they needed a partner in order to exploit these discounts, and Mr. Kaplan, based on his longstanding relationship, thought it was the latter rather than the former, and the district court credited that inference. I mean, isn't that the real argument?
Your Honor, I think you're absolutely correct. I mean, at most, what we have here are two viewpoints on the evidence of trial. At best, you have the Kaplan view, which is obviously that, you know, he felt that these were legitimate deals, that Mr. Smith was reaching out to him for the purpose of capitalizing on some things, but he didn't know what was going on, what the extent was of their investments. And then there's Regent's side of it. The district court sided with Mr. Kaplan, finding him to be a more credible witness, and the judge below found that the evidence was more in support of Mr. Kaplan's position. And that actually does go to whether or not you know, this issue merits reversal. The case law is abundantly clear that, especially on a trial of this magnitude, a mere disagreement or a conclusion, you know, by the reviewing court that maybe the evidence should have gone one way or the other is not enough. There must be some sort of manifest and clear error on behalf of the district court. And I believe your point is well taken, Your Honor. In this case, at best, there can be two views of the evidence, but the district court ultimately found that Mr. Kaplan was more credible, and that's just not a basis for reversal. So I'd also like to point out, as my time, I believe, is running up here, that despite all of the mountains of evidence that Regents claims to have against Mr. Kaplan on these issues, the real issue for Regents is that it's up against its own mountain. What Regents' position at trial, which was rejected by the district court, was that every person, third party, who ever looked into this case, including the FBI, the Secret Service, the U.S. Attorney, federal investigators, completely missed that Mr. Kaplan was, in fact, the principal co-conspirator with SAA. And of course, that's not the case. Mr. Kaplan was always labeled a victim, in fact, for the very same transactions that are here. And in fact, Regents was labeled a victim for these same transactions as well. I'd like to also comment very briefly before I conclude to Judge Rosenbaum's question with regard to the defamation issue. Your Honor, I believe that on the motion to dismiss, qualified immunity and absolute immunity would not have applied to third-party statements. That's in addition to the third-party statements that were made not only to Wells Fargo Bank and the Florida Bankers Association, but also to other third-party individuals, as was alleged in both the original complaint at paragraphs 155 and in the amended counterclaims at paragraphs 169 through 70.
Counsel, doesn't reports to law enforcement specifically are included within the qualified immunity and under what we call the litigation privilege in Florida?
They can be, Your Honor. However, because it's qualified immunity, there is an express malice exception to that, and that's a question of fact that should not have been decided on a motion to dismiss basis. It's not something that could have been examined and reviewed on the face of the pleadings.
2 minutes remaining.
Two minutes.
So, So in conclusion, with respect to that issue, there were a number of allegations.
I don't see where the allegations that allege that Regions and Shaw knew that Kaplan was engaged in check kiting, as opposed to that they should have known.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Could you clarify what?
I don't see where the allegations of the complaint allege that Regents and Shaw knew that Kaplan was not engaged in check kiting, as opposed to that they should have known that. And so I don't see how you can satisfy express malice.
Well, Your Honor, if you look to paragraph 170 of the amended counterclaim. It states specifically that despite the fact that they had no evidence or backing to support such a claim, Shaw and other representatives of Regions began to tell other third parties, including Wells Fargo.
Well, that may be that they should have known. That doesn't mean that they did know.
The next paragraph, Your Honor, states that this accusation was blatantly false and was made with absolutely no knowledge or support by Shaw acting in his capacity as an employee of Regions. Shaw, despite the fact that he should know better, falsely accused not just Kaplan.
That's just my point. I don't see where any of that alleges that they, in fact, knew.
Well, Your Honor, that may be an issue of fact that has to be examined later on through discovery.
Well,
it has
to be pleaded first.
Understood, Your Honor. I see that my time has expired now. Briefly in conclusion, the Kaplan parties are urging this court to rule in its favor, in their favor, on all the issues on appeal. We believe that the district court correctly decided the issues at trial, and Mr. Kaplan should be given his day at court. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wyrick. Mr. Ellison.
Yes, may it please the court. Jason Ellison for Bridgeview Bank Group. There are two categories of claims against Bridgeview Bank Group on appeal. The first is based in tort, and the second is based in alleged violations of banking statutes. First, as to the tort claims, it's undisputed that there were no direct representations or misrepresentations to the Kaplan parties. Bridgeview Bank's sole involvement in this matter was through banking activities. And because Bridgeview's exclusive involvement was through the processing of checks and rendering of routine banking services, it's displaced. All the claims, the tort claims, are displaced by the UCC. The exact actions the Kaplan entities take issue with in their common law claims are covered by the UCC and therefore preempted. The facts also support, at summary judgment, that no conspiracy took place. In order for the Kaplan parties to establish a claim for conspiracy, they would have to establish knowledge on behalf of Bridgeview Bank, as well as an agreement to participate in a Ponzi scheme. The facts simply do not bear this out. All of the evidence, all of the affidavits and declarations, but even most importantly, the expert reports. And this includes the expert reports of the Kaplan parties, which confirm that Bridgeview Bank did not violate any industry standard in its banking activities and through its routine banking services. Because Bridgeview didn't violate any industry standard, it would defy logic for a bank to participate in a Ponzi scheme. And because there's no knowledge or agreement, the conspiracy claim fails. The next category of claim against Bridgeview involves banking statutes. And this stems from Bridgeview's use of the return designation refer to maker for returning checks in the first and second deal transactions. All of the expert reports agree that refer to maker was permitted by law at the time that it was used. All expert reports agree that refer to maker was appropriate in these circumstances. And all the expert reports agree that no changes were made to the prior commentary. And because no changes were made to the prior commentary remained the operative guidance, was permitted by law, and was appropriate in these circumstances. Therefore, the district court opinion should be affirmed on these grounds. Finally,
what about at the point when Bridgeview learned that the account was being used for improper purposes and shut down the account or at least had knowledge that it should be shut down but didn't until the 24th? What about that gap?
Judge, Bridgeview never learned that the account was being used for improper purpose. The declaration...
Why on January 13th was there a decision made to close the account due to a volume of increased wire transfers?
That is the reason. The volume of increased wire transfers, Bridgeview Bank became just uncomfortable with the amount of wire activity in the account that had increased. I think Mr. Perkins may have said that
So there was a red flag, right?
No, Judge, not as far as any kind of fraud was concerned, and that's one of the reasons that Bridgeview returned it.
Why is a bank closing a long-standing customer's account with millions of dollars going in and out if there's not a red flag? Why would a bank do that?
The bank was no longer comfortable with the amount of activity in
because there was a red flag, right?
No, I don't believe so. I don't believe a bank can be uncomfortable with account activity with or without any kind of flag of any kind of improper activity going on. A bank can be uncomfortable with the
Bridgeview had a policy of allowing at least on a day-to-day basis an insufficiency as long as it was covered by the time the midnight window closed, right?
Judge, not this particular not an exclusive policy for this client, this customer. Bridgeview had numerous customers which it would allow their business banking customers to cover daylight.
So it had a policy allowing insufficiencies, and on the 13th had some information for which it knew the account should be closed because of some problem with the account, and yet it kept it open. How is that not negligent?
Judge, first of all, it's not negligent because those claims are displaced by the Uniform Commercial Code. But secondly,
the Uniform Commercial Code says anything about a policy to allow insufficiencies for over 24 hours and for not closing accounts. I don't think the UCC says anything about either of those things.
Well, the expert reports and the only expert reports rendered in this case and the expert testimony of the Kaplan Party's expert says that the Kaplan Party's that Bridgeview Bank did not violate any industry standards. So in order to be negligent, Bridgeview would have to violate some industry standard. And in this instance, they simply didn't do so.
Okay. We understand your argument, counsel, and it's time for Mr. Perkins to give us a few minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you, judges. Just a few points. One, the FBI never investigated a check kite. The FBI investigated a Ponzi scheme. But Mr. Kaplan and Regions agree that the litigation in this case is not a Ponzi scheme case.
I'm sorry, counsel. This is Robin Rosenbaum. If the FBI, I mean, generally, as you know, in order to obtain the best evidence that they can get, the FBI often will indict everybody, or grand jury to indict, or at least investigate, everybody who they think is involved in the crime. And then if they think that there is involvement, they might press charges against them as well and try to flip them up against the other person. Isn't that true?
I'm a civil litigator. It sounds right to me. But in this case, this kite was well hidden, Judge. The internal transfers that began on the day one of the kite rotation and ended every single day and this is uncontradicted evidence. From an individual account perspective, it hid the circular rotation of funds. And Mr. Kaplan's only explanation for these transfers, the internal transfers, that is, was to consolidate wires to save money on wire fees. But then we identified day after day, Mr. Kaplan sending 2, 3, or 4 transfers. So did the FBI not get wind of the check fight? That's what it seems like, but Regions did in the case below. And the
FBI does regularly investigate and bring to the grand jury charges of check kiting in other cases, doesn't it?
Sure. I wish they did in this case, but the investigation of a Ponzi scheme, which seems like it existed, doesn't change the fact that Mr. Kaplan floated checks to invest in what ultimately turned out to be a Ponzi scheme. And the Ponzi scheme turned into a kite. So it was the FBI wrong? I would say that the FBI was wrong.
Okay. Do you have anything more, Mr. Perkins? Go ahead, Mr. Perkins. Wrap it up.
Yes, Judge. Yes, Judges. So the email, in addition to Mr. Kaplan's express acknowledgement that insufficient funds in the bank account was the predicate for these deals, the email from Todd Smith with the first cut rotation is very express. It says, I will send you my checks tomorrow. You can cash my checks tomorrow morning, but my customer, at the same time you send the wire, but my customer payment will not post until later in the day. Mr. Kaplan didn't need to know.
Counsel, your time has expired.
Okay, Mr. Perkins, we understand your case and have it under submission, and thank you for your argument.